Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, my friends, and the reason I say friends, because if you're listening, you're a friend. Reading from the January 2015 edition of Playboy magazine. This is for the men. It's called Made Up Man. Is male vanity about to take a bold new turn? The answer may make you blush. The second time I ever met my Playboy editor over lunch, he kept telling me how young I looked. It was deeply creepy, creepier even than his suggestion that I write a long article in which I get trained to perform a breeze. Or as he pitched its story in a follow-up email, Joel adrift in a sea of tiny penises. Excuse me. Then I remembered I was wearing makeup. I'd come from an appearance on CNN and they'd run out of wipes, so I went straight to our lunch with powder caked on my face. Maybe concealer, too. I don't know all the terms, but apparently the stuff worked, even off camera. My skin was even and smooth, blemish-free. I looked good to a man who looked at airbrushed models all day. Which is why, in a not-too-distant future, men will start to wear makeup all the time. I figured this out when the dermatologist told me that the most important thing I could do is put moisturizer with sunscreen in it on my face every morning. When he recommended a specific brand, he warned me it had a little tint in it, which meant it had a bunch of makeup in it. And now some dudes are using a little tint. The rest of us have to, too, whether you want to or not. Look, I don't want to put on makeup any more than you do, but we men are highly susceptible to peer pressure. I didn't want to play fantasy sports. I didn't want to lift weights. I didn't want to wear these ball-strangling skinny jeans either. I sure as hell didn't want to wear a tie, but this shift is inevitable unless we band together to fight metrosexuality. Though honestly, the only thing that seems to work against metrosexuality is Sharia law, and I'd rather dip my head in a bucket of Lady Gaga's mascara than masturbate to nothing but a woman's eyes. It's already happening. Sephora, who had 8 items on its site under male makeup. Tom Ford put out a men's line last year. Menage, which names its man makeup manly things such as camo concealer, packages its manly chapstick light containers and males in manly cigar boxes, has been worn by regular dudes including Tom Hanks, Tim McGraw, and Neil Young. In South Korea, flower men such as Soccer Style and Young Kwon use and endorse makeup for guys. If we're willing to take up that Gangnam Style song from Korea, we're definitely taking their grooming trends. A men's manicure and pedicure shop in Los Angeles called Hammer and Nails is decorated with a punching bag, a rusted car grill, flat screen showing ESPN, and I'm guessing the pumped-in smell of farts. Sure, putting on makeup sounds crazy, but if I told you you in 1995 that one day you'd be trimming your pubes, you would have thought I was a gay porn producer in hiring mode. Excuse me. This is pretty funny. If you told your great-grandfather you wore deodorant, he would have mocked you for being a perfume-wearing pretty boy. If you get in a time machine and told your ancestors 3,000 years ago that you shaved your face, they would have beaten you with a club and enslaved you. Or you would have disrupted the space-time continuum and your image would have disappeared from photographs. I have no idea how time travel works. We put so many different kinds of gunk in our hair, and it's weird we don't fix our faces. All these powdered wig guys wore rouge a few centuries ago, and our looks are way more important. Now, if a guy doesn't post selfies, and he shouldn't, more images are taken him in a month than were taken of Henry VIII in his entire lifetime. Tinder photos compete with filters, Photoshop, and so it's crazy you don't start covering your zits. People look so much better with makeup on. Us Weekly devotes several pages to female celebrities who've been caught without it. Stars without makeup is what men look like all the time. Our skin is exactly the same as women's. We're operating at 10% of our potential. If someone figured out that putting on makeup on our... If someone figured out putting makeup on our dicks made them look bigger, we'd all have urinary tract infections. Oh, me. I'm not talking about putting on eyeliner like Adam Lambert or Russell Brand, or turning yourself into a bronze statue like John Boehner. I'm also not talking about giving yourself red lips and cheeks, which are designed to make women look like they're orgasming and men look like women who are orgasming. I simply mean putting a little bit of stuff on your face to get rid of the zits, wrinkles, redness, and shine. Anchorman makeup. This isn't the stuff of vanity that makes people notice you. It's the opposite. It's a way of blending in like an iron shirt or a properly fitted suit. So you can either wait to be the last puffy, wrinkly, spotted dude in America, or take advantage of this transitional moment, put on some moisturizer and tint, and out-handsome the competition. I know what chicks would do. That was kind of funny. Okay, here's an article for the ladies over here. It's called Gossip Girls. The only thing wrong with incessant gossip is that men don't appreciate it. Have you ever had this conversation with your mother, sister, aunt, grandmother? So you remember that girl from first grade or a former teacher, your old teacher? You, not really. She, of course you remember. Insert something you have zero recollection of. You'll have no idea who you're talking about. The one, okay, I guess I know her. Why? Have you heard? She's sick, dead. Dead to me, divorced, a lottery winner, but now bankrupt and fat. Now, if you're a man, you're probably confused by the stroll down memory lane just to hear the awful news about someone you'd forgotten existed. But if you're a woman, you get it. Even though you couldn't pick the girl out if you rode the bus to day camp without a lineup, you'd be glad to know she went through a messy divorce with a man twice her age and got fat. To me, have you heard is one of the greatest starts to a sentence that a sentence can have. This has gotten me into a lot of trouble over the years. I once gossiped about someone's dad being in prison, only to find out I was talking to the man's daughter. Then I had to backtrack and say it really wasn't that big a deal, and it really wasn't such a big deal, and I'm sure he was innocent. He most certainly was not. I dished about who slept with whom, who didn't sleep with whom, who gave whom a hand job on a wedding party bus in front of the bride's family, but I committed my worst gossip faux pas in my early 20s. It kind of, sort of, totally, casually implicated someone in a murder. Yes, murder. It wasn't great. Turns out nobody wants to be implicated in a murder, even casually. I learned that the hard way when friends of the person I'd implicated called me out and called me names. Also, people love repeating that someone they know could be implicated in a murder. If you mention someone might be implicated in a murder, it's going to spread like wildfire. So my advice is don't implicate anyone in murders just to be safe. I felt horrible. I know it's wrong to gossip, it's rude, tacky, downright despicable, but so damn irresistible. Men don't really gossip. I don't get it. It's frustrating because my guy could go to dinner with a dude who's in the middle of a juicy breakup and come back and say he just talked about football and work. I mean, come on, nada. And I asked the question to sound as though I care. Do you think he still talks to the woman he had that affair with? I imagine it's hard for her, too. What's her name again? I go deep down there to a gossip animal begging to be fed. That's why every January I resolve to quit. It's a terrible habit, a dangerous habit. You can hurt a person's feelings. You can spread untrue rumors. You can wrongfully implicate someone in a murder. Gossiping can have emotional, romantic, and legal implications even if you don't realize it. Your whispering could get an investigation reopened, for example. It makes me feel guilty to think that I could cause any of that. But it doesn't stop me from feeling as though I'm sitting on a diamond mine when I have some information, because it's all about information. Boyfriends have asked me in the past why I love to gossip so much. Well, that's it. Information is social power. You want to be the first to tell someone something. And because other people love it too, it's currency. But I'm not a bad person. And I don't think most gossips are. When we clutch our chests and say, bless her heart, after finding out someone has diabetes, an infected belly button piercing, or worse, we mean it. We may take an ugly pleasure in spreading the news, but at the root of it, we feel bad. We want to help. We want to send flowers or food or unfriend the ex on Facebook. Every little thing helps. Yet we can't escape the seduction of information. Why do we think celebrity rags sell so well? We all want to know the gory details of everyone else's lives. Excuse me. I would read a People magazine just about people I went to high school with. I think when it comes down to it, the things we gossip about are the things we're worried about happening to us. Disease, death, divorce, tax audits. If something does happen to us, at least it also happened to someone else. The grass isn't always greener. Maybe their grass was foreclosed on and their wife had an affair with the guy who mowed it. Other people have problems too. I know people gossip about me. I broke my vagina once, not telling that to someone. But I know it's not great to gossip. I should spend my time doing more productive things like reading the classics, falling asleep during movie versions of them. This year's the year I'm resolved. I'm really going to try to stop the gossip for good. But real quick before I do, I'd like to point out that nobody was arrested for that murder. Just saying. Excuse me. Okay, it's time for the advisor. My wife and I have been married for more than 2 decades, and she's had increasing trouble getting wet. We started using lube during sex, which gave us a bonus thrill. I got into the habit of going down on her and using my tongue to spread the gel around in the tube and lube up my fingers before then inserting them into her vagina. Once while we were engaging in foreplay, I put my lube finger near her ass and she started to moan. So I inserted my finger and she went wild with excitement. This became part of our foreplay routine, with my wife climaxing intensely whenever I inserted my finger into her anus. We graduated to anal sex and now have it at least once a month. Why is anal stimulation causing her such intense climaxes? Second, I've heard it can be bad for your health. Could our bedroom practice cause our bodies harm? Congratulations, you're finding out a new way to enjoy sex together at this stage of your relationship. And kudos to you both, you're on the same page regarding anal sex. Let's put your lucky discovery into perspective. You've stumbled upon the pleasures of the taint, slang for what's otherwise known as the perineum. It's a nerve pack pleasure center that slang suggests ain't the vagina and it ain't the anus. When your finger on your wife's anus, in addition to putting pressure on the perineum, it also stimulates the entire clitoral complex, which extends for beyond the invisible external portion of the clitoris deep into the vaginal cavity. Inserting your penis into the anus can also put pressure on the clitoral complex. As for health concerns, as long as you're gentle and sufficiently lubricated, you'll be fine. You should wear a condom to protect yourself from potential urinary tract infections and protect your wife. And to protect your wife, you should refrain from following anal with vaginal sex. The fact you're using gel and have anal sex only once a month and your wife isn't experiencing any pain leads us to believe you're doing it the right way. And you might be interested to know you're on a trend. Studies show that heterosexual anal sex is on the upswing. See the question below for further proof that we're having a bit of an anal moment. Hold on, I got to have a bit of a water moment. Throat's a little dry. A little scratchy, too. Can I suggest a good prostate massager? Can you suggest a good prostate massager? I'm looking for a product that has been recommended by a real doctor and made in the USA. FDA approved would be nice. And is safe. Is there any proven health benefits to a prostate massage? Or is everything I've read on the internet junk science intended to get me to buy something? Some alternate medicine professionals believe prostate massage may alleviate the pain suffered by men with prostatitis. That is an inflamed or infected prostate gland. But there are no credible studies that back up this belief. Most doctors recommend modifications to diet and behavior and sometimes prescribe antibiotics to treat prostatitis. If you suspect you have this condition, by all means, seek professional medical advice, but if you count sexual satisfaction as a component of mental health, then yes, prostate massager could be a useful tool if you're interested in this exploring anal play. But let's call a prostate massager what it is, a sex toy. More precisely, it's a variation of a dildo designed to put pressure on your prostate when inserted. Although you'll find some websites that tout the medical benefits of a prostate massage, seldom are these sites run by medical professionals. More often, they're not. They encourage you to buy the particular product. Cleverly named Anaros, considered the best prostate massager out there, is made with FDA-approved medical-grade plastic, and happy customers report intense orgasms from prostate stimulation alone. I'm a newly widowed 40-year-old man and also visually impaired. I'm ready to date, but this is the first time I will be trying as a blind man. Once upon a time, I was accustomed to using eye contact to know when a woman might be interested. What do you suggest I do when it comes to flirting? There's no surefire trick beyond becoming a sensitive listener and upping your verbal charm. But even for the sighted, it can be tough to pick someone up and out in the real world, especially when it seems as though every single person in the bar is waiting for a date they found online or through an app. Rather than try to work around this enhanced technology, datingfordisabled.com is one option. As is the immensely popular dating site OkCupid, which compare you with sighted and blind partner matches. Okay. A few months ago, Playboy published an article that claimed denim jacket is always in style. I recently wore an old faded blue jean jacket and found someone asked if I was celebrating Throwback Thursday. I couldn't care less about the comment, but I am curious about the type of jackets that are still in style. I have a few left in my closet, a classic Levi's dark blue denim jacket, which according to the article is in style, heavily faded, nearly whitewashed looking jacket, a black denim jacket, and a couple of colored guest jackets that still fit well. Well, one is dark olive green, the other is tan, which are safe to wear. It sounds as though you have a solid collection of jackets that you continue to hold on to and still be serve you through the decades of shifting trends. Colored denim is still in style. Neutrals are always okay. We're not surprised it was your faded denim jacket that inspired the Throwback Thursday comment. Darker denim is currently more in favor, while faded is strongly associated with the 1980s. If you're living in a hipster neighborhood in New York or Los Angeles, where retro is styles abound, you might actually have gotten a compliment, but we, like you, don't care. Giving a shit about what you wear is not giving a shit about what other people think about what you're wearing. It's one of the hallmarks of a man of substantial style. What color you wear and fit is foremost. As long as you cut, as the cut and color flatter your body and coloring, you're a man enough to rock them fearlessly, you should be fine. Sartorial fearlessness is always in fashion. That said, fashion trends, turn the page, repeat themselves, so chances are good that in a couple of years your faded denim jacket will be all the rage in Northboro again. Several times a month, I go out with a large group of friends for a weekend dinner so we can catch up. The meal typically consists of drinks, salad, appetizers, a main course, dessert, and occasionally coffee. At our last dinner, we stayed at the steakhouse for more than 2.5 hours on a Saturday night. We talked for 45 minutes after finishing dessert. The tables around us turned over twice with new customers. Is there a time limit on how long we should observe etiquette that we should follow? Leaving immediately after we finish eating would definitely help the restaurant owner and relieve the wait for diners arriving after. Some people in our group are a little more European in their attitude and feel dinner should be a relaxed process. Unlike the rest of us, they don't seem to think our long stays are problematic. Any guidance or advice would be appreciated. Restaurateurs expect tables to take roughly 90 minutes to 2 hours for seating. Tables of four take 2.5 to 3 hours, and larger groups take even longer. So for a time standpoint, it doesn't sound as though you're outside the norm for a group as large as yours. And the fact that you're ordering a decent amount of food as well as drinks goes a long way to justifying your time. Still, no matter the size of your party, staying past dessert for 45 minutes puts everyone in an awkward spot. It looks downright inconsiderate to the restaurant and to any diners who might be waiting for a table to simply be talking and not partaking in essential goods and services. When a restaurant needs your table, the employees will let you know, subtly at first by offering to wrap your leftovers to go, and then obviously by perhaps asking if guests need their valet ticket stamped. And lastly, by outright stating that the party is waiting for it to take the table. That said, we love a long, unrushed, European-styled meal. If you're uncomfortable in occupying a table for an extended period of time, instead of trying to police your fellow diners' behavior and pressuring them to end the night, you might want to suggest taking the last reservation of the evening, say 8 p.m. or later, which in most cases will buy you an extra half an hour or so of time to allow you to shut down the restaurant without worrying about other parties waiting for your table. Take care not to push it too late. You don't want the last table and be the last table in the place with the lights turned up and all the busboys and cooks sitting around staring at you. Where does the advisor stand on circumcision debate? My obstetrician and pediatrician are vague on the subject, and the American Academy of Pediatrics doesn't seem to take a clear stance either. I know there are possible health benefits of circumcision to consider, but what about the sexual pros and cons? Do uncircumcised men enjoy sex more? And what about their female partners? The advisor's position on this is that there are pros and cons in both decisions. We're not about to tell anyone what they should do with their or their son's penis when it comes to practices that don't cause obvious harm. Circumcision is at the center of the biggest debate surrounding our privates, and there hasn't been much measured reporting on the subject. You could argue that it's traumatic for the child, but we have seen no compelling evidence that circumcised men suffer lasting physical or psychological effects. Some people claim it's medically unnecessary and unjustified. Male circumcision has been shown to significantly reduce the rate of spread of HIV in southern and eastern Africa. Removing the foreskin reduces the possibility of tears and infection. It also reduces the number of infectable cells. But practicing abstinence or using a condom is equally effective. The Mayo Clinic recently published a comprehensive review of studies that related to circumcision and concluded that the procedure reduces the risk of urinary tract infections, STDs, and prostate cancer. But good hygiene and, again, safe sex are equally, if not more, effective measures. Some people cite looking normal as the reason to circumcise, but normal is relative. In the U.S., roughly 50% of male newborns are circumcised, while in Europe, only 10% are. The Council of Europe, Pan-European Human Rights Organization, is lobbying to curtail the infant circumcision on the grounds it's not medically necessary and therefore violates a child's human rights. Of course, Jews and Muslims justify circumcision on religious grounds. As for the pleasure, yet again, studies contradict one another. All that said, the advisor does have its own adult friend, more than one adult friend who passed on the matter, who, when pressed on the matter, admitted to wishing they still had the tips of their dicks, which may explain why the U.S. circumcision rates are slowly declining. If you choose not to circumcise your son, you can always go in for a snip on his own when he turns 18. Okay, I think we have time for one more letter here. When I travel for business, I usually carry a soft, expensive... let's try another one. That sounds boring. Well, here's a short one. My wife and I originally started getting back into sex for the first time after the birth of our child. The first couple of go-arounds, she developed terrible urinary tract infections. What are we not doing correctly? Do I need to Purell myself and gargle peroxide? To reduce the potential for infection, you could both bathe before sex. She should bathe afterward and urinate before and after sex and stay hydrated to flush out the urethra. If she is using a diaphragm, she can always increase the chances of developing a urinary tract infection. Try another form of birth control. Maybe one more. My question deals with proper gifting etiquette. I'm one of three children. I have one son, my brother has twins, and my sister has three children. Each year we exchange for the various holidays and birthdays. Is it proper to give each child a gift in the same amount, say $50, or should cost be somewhat on a sliding scale? Christmas is about the kids. If you want to bring down the average expenditure, you could take advantage of this Christmas post-holiday sales and use possible suggested retail prices or costs. Then everyone, including you, will treat it fairly. Well, that's our show for today. Hope you enjoyed it. Thanks for listening to all my friends around the world, and we'll see you next time. Have a great day, great night, wherever you are.